Calvin Hobbes stars as Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, with Graham Armitage as Alfred Wood. In Roger Waddis' dramatization, Conan Doyle investigates.
A macabre, unbelievable story this, but it all happened. My name is Wood, Alfred Wood. In 1906, shortly before Christmas, some papers arrived on my desk at Hindhead in Surrey. They were addressed to my employer, for whom I worked as secretary. His name was Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. At that time, Sir Arthur was still grieving over the death of his wife, Louise, who had died several months previously after a long illness. He was sick with despair, unable to work. But the routine of life went on. I took the papers and the morning mail into him.
Good morning, Sir Arthur.
Good morning, Alfred.
I think we're in for snow.
It started. Snowflakes. She loved to watch them.
Quite a correspondence this morning, sir. Close on 70 letters.
Oh, yes?
There's one from Rudyard Kipling. He says he read Sir Nigel in one gulp.
Did he?
Here we are. From cover to cover I read it, and I put it down, still hungry for more.
That's more than the critics said.
Oh, a good many of the reviews have been very laudatory, sir. I think it'll find its way into the bestseller list.
I doubt it, Alfred. The public seem to think I shouldn't be writing historical novels. They see me as the creator of Sherlock Holmes and nothing more.
Well, it's true a lot of these letters are about Holmes. They want more stories.
They've had the return of Sherlock Holmes. That should content them.
Evidently not, sir. I don't think Holmes can ever die again. He can only retire.
Yes, he's been condemned to life. Oh, well, I suppose I'd better deal with these. Is there anything of especial interest here?
Yes, sir. There's a man who asked for your help. He sent some press cuttings. They're near the top of the pile.
The umpire? I've never heard of it. Edelge protests his innocence. Who is this man, Edelge?
George Edelge, sir. He's just come out of prison. He served 3 years for killing a horse, but claims he was wrongly convicted.
Does he indeed? Leave these papers with me, Alfred. I'd like to study them.
That was how it started. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the world's most famous writer of detective stories, suddenly found himself face to face with a real-life mystery, more bizarre than anything even he had penned. He read every word of the 6 lengthy articles George Edalji had written in the weekly paper, The Umpire.
Alfred! Alfred!
Sir?
Have you read these cuttings?
No, sir. Only glanced at them.
They're incredible. If this man is telling the truth, and I believe he is, it's an appalling story. 3 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit and then released without a pardon.
You mean he's still considered guilty?
As far as society is concerned, yes.
That's pretty hard, sir.
Look, I want you to get hold of all the available documents in the case, press reports and so on, especially of the trial. I shall write to anyone who can testify, but first of all to Edalji. Either he's guilty or he's not. If he is, he deserves every day of his 7 years, his original sentence. If he is not, then we must have apology, pardon and restitution.
Could almost be a Holmes story, sir.
No, Alfred. This goes far beyond the invention of any writer of detective fiction. And there's a real human being on the rack here. Now, we're in the presence of an appalling tragedy, and I feel called upon to do what I can to set it right.
And so, in 1906, Conan Doyle took up the case of George Edalji, a case that had brought misery and despair to a harmless family living in Great Wyrley, an agricultural and mining village 6 miles from Walsall in Staffordshire. The head of the family was the Reverend Shapoorji Edalji, an Indian who had become a Church of England clergyman. He was married to an Englishwoman, Charlotte. They had a daughter, Maud, and their son, George, was a solicitor with a practice in Birmingham. But their suffering goes back many years before. In 1892, the persecution began, and it went on for 3 years. A flood of anonymous letters arrived at various homes in the district, but above all, at the vicarage.
This one's about me. I swear by God that I will murder George Edalji soon. The only thing I care about in this world is revenge, revenge, revenge. Sweet revenge I long for. Then I shall be happy in hell.
No, oh no.
There's more, Mother. Every day, every hour, my hatred is growing against George Edalji. May the Lord strike me dead if I don't murder him.
Dear God.
Listen to this one. Do you think, you Pharisee, that because you are a parson, God will absolve you from your iniquity? To hell with your damned wife and your horrid little girl.
Mother!
I will descend into the infernal region, showering curses upon you all.
Now, there,
why?
Darling.
Why?
Don't more. It's all right.
It is worse than 4 years ago. I thought we had seen the end of it.
Worse than 4 years ago. In 1888, threatening anonymous letters had been received at the vicarage. Abusive writings about the Adalges were found scrawled on buildings and outhouses. But the later letters were different. The earlier ones had been ribald. These were malignant, filled with diabolical hatred for the Adalges, and a passionate, not to say religious, admiration for the local police.
The following in this district we love truly. The police of Kennick in general, and Sergeant Upton in particular. Hurrah for Upton, good old Upton, dear old Upton, blessed Upton. Stand up for Upton, ye soldiers of the cross. Lift high your royal banner, it must not suffer loss.
Then came the hoaxes, senseless, practical jokes which went on for 3 years. One said that the vicarage was to be let for the most dubious purposes. Another described the Reverend Adalge as a matrimonial agent, with a number of ladies on his books whose charms were catalogued in realistic detail. But it was the curious incident of the key, stolen from Walsall Grammar School, which brought matters to a head. On December the 12th, 1892, Sergeant Upton interviewed the Reverend Adalge.
You say you found this key on your doorstep?
Yes, Sergeant.
And you have no idea how it came there?
None at all.
Why do you think anyone should steal a key from Walsall Grammar School and leave it at the vicarage?
I cannot imagine.
You cannot imagine. Your son, George, now, he doesn't go to Walsall?
No, Sergeant, he is at Rudesley School, but that is 6 or 7 miles from
Walsall. I know how far it is.
I cannot believe you are suggesting that my...
I didn't say that.
Why should George do that? Why should he steal this key from Walsall and bring it all the way back and put it on his own
door? It's my job to ask the questions, sir. And find the right answers, and we'll find them, never fear.
Sergeant Upton made a report, which duly came before Captain the Honourable George Alexander Anson, Chief Constable of Staffordshire.
About this key business, Sergeant.
Sir?
You make it pretty clear in this report who you think the culprit is.
Yes, sir.
What sort of fellow is he, young George Adalge?
Well, he's, funny looking, sir.
Funny? In what way?
It's his eyes, sir. Now, they sort of bulge. And when he looks at you, he doesn't seem to see you. Stares right through you as if you weren't there.
Hmm. Anything else?
He's very dark.
Huh?
He's Indian, sir. Well, half, anyway.
So I believe. His father's vicar of Great Wylie?
That's right, sir. Now, he's full Indian.
And married to an English woman?
Yes, sir.
Hmm. There's no hard evidence against young Adalge, I suppose.
Nothing that'll carry much weight in court, sir.
That's pity.
Mind you, sir, he could have done it.
Hmm?
There don't seem to be any other likely suspects.
Yet, just a feeling you have about him.
You could put it like that, sir.
Well, that's all policemen have to go on most of the time. Their instinct.
Yes, sir.
Right. Well, that's all, Sergeant. Thank you. January the 23rd, 1893. To the Reverend S. Adalge, Vicarage, Great Wylie, Staff. Will you please ask your son George from whom the key was obtained, which was found on your doorstep on December the 12th?
The key was stolen. But if it can be shown that the whole thing was due to some idle freak or practical joke, I should not be inclined to allow any police proceedings to be taken in regard to it.
What does he mean, Father?
We shall see, George. Captain Anson goes on. If, however, the persons concerned in the removal of the key refuse to make any explanation of the subject, I must necessarily treat the matter in all seriousness as theft.
What is he getting at?
I may say at once that I shall not pretend to believe any protestations of ignorance which your son may make about this key.
Father, I'm not a thief. I didn't steal that key. Why does he make these accusations?
I wish I knew, my son.
The anonymous letters and the hoaxes continued for another 2 years.
Just because you pretend to be learning about law, you think you can play your dirty tricks and everybody keep quiet. But you'll get caught.
Of the police is watching you. Don't you know that you're black swan?
At the end of 1895, the letters and hoaxes were suddenly switched off. Peace came to Great Wiley, and it lasted for 7 years, during which time George had become a solicitor and opened a practice in Birmingham. Then, in 1903...
Someone's killed my cow.
They've done two of my sheep.
A mare in foal, ripped up the belly.
Now the victims were harmless animals, savagely mutilated. And with these outrages came more anonymous letters. Some of them bore the forged signature of a local schoolboy called Greatorex, who was away in the Isle of Man when they were written. But the name of Greatorex was to acquire a special significance later in the story. Madness ran through all these letters. One of them contained a threat which spread terror throughout the village.
There will be merry times at Wiley in November when they start on little girls. For they will do 20 wenches like the artists before next March.
The police have got to do something.
Go and see them.
Come on, we're going to see Sergeant Wellington.
Let's all go.
Now, what's all this?
Well, look at this letter. Now they're talking of killing little girls.
We want the swine's court. Now, what are you doing about it, Sergeant?
We've got men looking for them every night.
Yes, but it's been going on for 6 months.
Oh, easy. We'll get them.
A letter for the sergeant.
Sergeant Robinson, you bloated blackguard. I will shoot you with father's gun through your thick head. If you come in my way, I'll go sneaking to any of my pals.
Dozens of police were drafted into Wiley from all over Staffordshire. It was almost impossible to move about the fields without bumping into policemen, both in and out of uniform. Some were disguised as colliers. Others adopted an even more elaborate disguise. One night, a young girl, returning home from a dance in Cannock, tumbled over a dark object as she was crossing a field.
Who's there? What is it?
It was a horse, or rather a pantomime horse, and the horse spoke.
Hurry along, madam. We're police officers.
In the end, the whole exercise degenerated into chaos. Gangs of young lads poured into Great Wiley from Rugeley, Stafford, and Birmingham to mock the hapless constables. Many of them spent a night cooling off in the cells of Cannock, but no one was arrested for cattle maiming. It was at this stage that Captain Anson took personal charge of operations.
Inspector Campbell?
Sir?
We don't seem to be getting anywhere on this business at Great Wiley.
We're doing all we can, sir.
It's not good enough, Inspector. Nowhere good enough. I want action, so does the public.
I know. Ceiling's running pretty high, sir.
Pretty high? How many men do you have at Wiley, Inspector?
12, sir, including specials. We have to get a couple from Bridgetown. We're pretty stretched.
Make it 20, even if it means taking men off their other duties.
Yes, sir.
You're watching the vicarage?
Yes, sir, every night.
That's where we'll get our man. I'm convinced of it.
You mean that darkie, sir?
Yes. I'm damn sure he's behind the killings and those anonymous letters. Oh, they can become lawyers and parsons and doctors, but underneath it all, they're still primitive savages.
It makes you wonder, sir.
Well, you know what to do, Inspector. Get after George Adalji. I want an arrest.
Around-the-clock vigil was kept on the vicarage from the nearby cemetery. Police, hiding behind tombstones, watched every coming and going. At night, cotton was trailed right round the house and examined in the morning to see if it had been broken. It never was. Then, on the morning of August the 18th, 1903, Henry Garrett, a young miner, was crossing a field on his way to work at the Great Wiley Colliery.
Oh. Help! Help! Over here!
Hey! What is it, lad?
Look! The pony! They've done the pony!
Well, I got ripped up the belly, just like the others.
All the blood!
I know, lad. And I think it's still alive, poor creature. Let her be shot. Oh, I know what I'd like to do. I'd like to...
Who's shouting? What's your man? Over here, constable.
Oh, what's all the... Oh, my. Another one. Now, you find him?
Yes.
The madman. Mad beggar.
No, we'll get him. He ate in 6 months. But we'll get him.
Now then, where's my whistle?
2 hours later at the vicarage, the Reverend Adalgie was having breakfast with his wife and daughter.
You're not eating, dear.
They seem to have no appetite, Charlotte.
You're not unwell.
Oh, no, but I am not hungry. There's nothing to be disturbed about.
You're worried, aren't you, Father? All these terrible things happening.
It has been a strain for everyone, Maud. We must bear it with fortitude.
I wish it were all over. Get on with your breakfast, Maud. Who could that be? It's barely 8 o'clock.
I'm expecting no one.
A parishioner, perhaps?
It is possible.
Oh, well, I'll go.
No, Charlotte. I will go.
Do you think it is a parishioner, Mama? Can't imagine who else.
This way, please. It is the police, dear.
Oh.
Inspector Campbell, Staffordshire County Constabulary, Sergeant Robinson, Constable Harris.
My wife, Charlotte, and this is my daughter, Maud.
Where is your son, George?
He has left for business. He practices as a solicitor in Birmingham.
He always catches the 7:30 train. But what's wrong, Inspector? Why do you want to see him?
Another animal was cut up last night, a colliery pony, not half a mile from here.
Oh, no.
What has this to do with George?
Perhaps you could tell me something of your son's movements last evening.
He came home from his office in Birmingham at the usual time, about 6:30. He brought some papers home with him to work on. He often does.
And he stayed in all night?
No.
He went out again, maybe.
Yes, but...
What time would that be?
Well, I'm not sure, Inspector. I was working in my study. Charlotte, did...
It was shortly after 8 o'clock. He said he was going to the bootmakers at Bridgetown.
He said he was going there?
Well, I'm sure he did go there.
That can be confirmed if we could have the bootmaker's name.
Oh, excuse me, sir. It's John Hand. I know, because I take my boots there for repair.
Right, Constable. Perhaps you'd ask him to corroborate.
Yes, sir.
Not now, man.
No, sir. Sorry, sir.
Now, sir. What time did your son return home from his trip to the bootmakers?
I'm not sure.
I remember, Father. It was about 9:25.
How can you be sure of the exact time, Miss...
I was in the hall when he came in. He asked me whether we had started supper yet, and I said no, we'd be having it in a few minutes. We usually eat at 9:30.
And did you last night?
Yes.
And after supper, did your son go out again?
No. We talked for a little while, and then we went to bed.
Inspector, why are you asking all these questions? My son has done nothing wrong. He's a man of respect, a member of the legal profession.
Reverend Adalgie, a serious crime has been committed. It's my duty to make inquiries, and you will all be helping me in the performance of that duty by answering some of my questions. Now, madam, I understand you to say that your son, George Adalgie, retired to bed sometime after supper. It's possible, is it not, that he left the house again sometime later without you knowing?
No, Inspector. Quite impossible.
Why do you say that?
Because he sleeps in the same room as I do.
Is that your normal practice?
Yes. It has been so for about 17 years.
My daughter, Maud, here, has been in delicate health since she was a child. I sleep with her in case she should need me during the night.
I see.
I am a light sleeper. I suffer from lumbago. If my son had left the house at any time, I would have known it. I would have heard him unlocking the door.
You keep your door locked? Why?
I have always done so, as many people do. To keep unwanted visitors out.
Or to keep your son in.
What are you suggesting?
I'm suggesting nothing. I'm merely asking. Is your son in the habit of roaming about at night?
No, he is not.
I'd be obliged, madam, if you would show me any outer clothing belonging to your son and his outdoor boots.
Oh, really?
It's all right, Shepherd. Let us do as the inspector asks.
Constable, go with Mrs. Adalgie.
Yes, sir.
Sergeant, see how the men are getting on in the garden.
Very good, sir.
The garden? What are they doing in the garden?
Looking for buried weapons.
Oh, Sergeant, if they've drawn a blank, have a look around the house.
Yes, sir.
You won't find anything, Inspector.
Why, is it hidden?
No, I didn't mean that.
There is nothing to find. Nothing.
We shall see. If I have to take this house apart brick by brick...
This is intolerable. We are not criminals.
Father, don't upset yourself.
I am a man of God.
Then you should have nothing to fear, sir.
These are George's things, Inspector.
Put them on the table, will you, Constable?
Yes.
What have we got here? These boots. Are they the one your son was wearing when he went out last night?
Yes, I believe so.
Still wet, I see. And muddy. And these trousers are in the same condition?
Well, yes, he was wearing those.
I see his coat. There are stains on the sleeve.
Oh, look. But they're food stains.
Are they? These white stains could be animal saliva from the pony. And these dark spots could be blood. Anyway, we shall see. We shall have this coat tested.
But George never wore that coat to go out. It is an old house coat.
Then why is it still damp?
Well, it cannot be. Let me feel it. No. It is not damp. You are mistaken, Inspector. It is perfectly dry.
And I say it is damp. Yes, Sergeant.
Nothing in the garden so far, sir, but I found these things upstairs.
Let's have a look at them. The case first. Now we'll have it open. Razor. Cutthroat razor.
Is they or mine?
This one's got blood on it.
But that is not blood, can't you see? That is rust.
Well, test it, too. What have we got here? Looks like a dagger.
I believe it belongs to the young lady, sir. Haven't I seen you out with it?
Yes, but it's not a dagger.
Huh? And what is it?
A trowel. A botany trowel. I use it for collecting specimens.
What kind of specimens?
Wild flowers and other things.
Huh? What about this box?
It's a vasculum.
A what?
A vasculum.
And what's a vasculum?
I keep these specimens in it.
It's a dangerous kind of thing to me. Now, this coat. There's a hair there. It looks like a horse hair.
No, it's just a piece of thread. You're right, Mother. I'm sure it's a roving.
How about this then? That's a horse hair, all right.
I don't see anything. Let me take it to the window. No, I don't see anything.
And I see there is, Mr. Edelge. I am taking this coat with me.
You may take it, Inspector. I am sure you will find nothing on it.
I came here to find evidence, and evidence I shall find.
Evidence of what?
Your son's guilt, Mrs. Edelge.
Later that day, Inspector Campbell and another policeman travelled to Birmingham for the purpose of calling on George at his office in Newhall Street.
Come in. Mr. George Edelge.
Yes?
We are police officers. I'm Inspector Campbell. This is my sergeant.
What's the trouble, Inspector?
We're making some inquiries about a horse that was maimed at Great Wyrley last night.
Oh, yes, I heard something about it when I was coming to business this morning.
Mr. Edelge, I visited your home this morning. Your mother showed me certain clothes belonging to you with marks and stains upon them.
Well, it was probably an old coat I wear about the house, and you might find some grease on it.
These were white stains, sir.
It might be milk or oatmeal.
We also found hairs on the coat. Now, how do you explain these things?
They must have come through the material.
I think not, sir. These were horse hairs.
Then I must have got them from leaning on gates and fences where horses have been.
I'm not satisfied with your explanations, Mr. Edelge. I'm taking you into custody.
Taking me into custody? What for? What are you charging me with, Inspector?
Willfully mutilating a pony belonging to the Great Wyrley Colliery sometime during the evening of August the 17th.
You're not obliged to say anything now. But we must caution you that anything you do say will be written down and may be given in evidence.
But where's your evidence? You have no evidence. What time was this done?
I can't hold a conversation with you now. We don't want to search you here, but I must ask you to let us have your pistol.
Pistol? I have no pistol.
Then what's that on the desk, sir? That's a pistol, isn't it?
That's a railway carriage door key.
We were only joking. Now, I want you to go with me to the Birmingham police office.
I'm not surprised at this. I've been expecting it for some time.
Have you got that, Sergeant?
Yes, sir. I have. It's all down.
The next day, George appeared before the magistrates at Cannock. A prima facie case was made out, and the prisoner committed for trial at the Staffordshire Quarter Sessions on October the 20th, 1903.
George Edelge, you are charged with having, on or about August the 17th, 1903, at Great Wyrley in the county of Staffordshire, maliciously wounded a horse, the property of the Great Wyrley Colliery Company Limited, and with having, on or about July the 11th, 1903, at Hensford in the county of Staffordshire, sent a letter to Police Sergeant Robinson threatening to murder him. How do you plead to these charges? Guilty or not guilty?
Not guilty.
Sir Reginald Hardy, presiding, was a county justice who had had no legal training.
Your Honour.
Yes, Clark. What is it?
The prosecution is waiting, sir.
Oh, yes. Mr. DiStano, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honour. Your Honour, members of the jury, this is no ordinary case. Yet the facts I submit speak for themselves. Briefly stated, they are as follows. A pony was found maliciously wounded early on the morning of August 18th in a field near Great Wyrley Colliery. The prisoner was seen out of his house between 9 and approximately 9:30 on the night of the 17th. Police testimony will be given to this effect. Another feature of the case, to which the prosecution attaches considerable importance, is that a number of anonymous letters have come into the possession of the police. For testimony in this matter, I should like to call Mr. Thomas Gurridge. Garin, what is your profession?
I am a chirographist.
In layman's language, a handwriting expert.
That is correct.
And a very eminent one, I think it would be true to say.
I believe I enjoy the esteem of my fellow professionals.
Quite. You have examined the anonymous letters sent to the police and to other people accusing Georgie Dalzy of maiming cattle, horses, and sheep.
I have.
Were some of these letters addressed to Dalzy?
They were.
Were you able to form an opinion as to the authorship of these letters?
I was.
Were they all, in your judgment, written by the same hand?
They were.
Whose hand?
Georgie Dalzy.
He wrote some of these letters himself.
Yes, but in a disguised handwriting.
Exactly so.
One moment, Mr. D'Sternal.
Your Honor?
The jury will no doubt wish to hear an explanation from you as to why the prisoner should write letters to himself, accusing himself of these crimes.
I was coming to that, Your Honor. It is our contention that the object was to bring him into contact with the police so as to ascertain all they knew about the crime.
I see. please continue.
Thank you, Your Honor. It is your considered opinion, then, Mr. Gunn, your expert opinion, that all these anonymous letters were penned by the accused.
It is.
There is no doubt in your mind on this score.
None whatsoever.
Thank you, Mr. Gunn.
Less than a year later, this expert was to admit that his testimony had helped to send an innocent man, Adolf Beck, to prison in 1896.
We now come to another outrage. The killing of a horse on September the 21st.
Oh.
The defense will no doubt say, and fairly say, that that crime could not have been committed by the prisoner because he was lying in Stafford Jail at the time. I will, however, ask the jury to suspend their judgment in reference to this matter until they have heard the whole of the case. The letters which will be read will show that the writer of them was not acting alone, but in conjunction with some other person. And I put it to the jury, if there were a gang operating in the way suggested, what was more likely than that one of its members should commit a similar outrage in order to create evidence for the defense?
Later, Inspector Campbell was cross-examined by Mr. Vachel, defending counsel.
Campbell, have you discovered who killed the horse on September the 21st?
No, sir. I beg your pardon, sir. We have an idea.
Have you made an arrest?
No, sir.
Has anyone admitted to you that he did it?
Yes.
Is that person in court?
He is here.
Brought here by the police?
Yes.
What is his name?
John Harry Green.
He lives at Green Park?
Yes. The farmer's son.
Green was never prosecuted. He was allowed to leave the country and go to South Africa. Defense cross-examined Police Constable Cooper.
Constable, you have said you traced the prisoner's footmarks from the vicarage to the field where the horse was found.
Yes, sir.
When did you do this?
Sometime after 9:30 on the morning of August the 18th.
When the ground had been trampled in all directions by miners going to work and by curious sightseers.
There were other footprints, yes, sir.
Yet you managed to single out those of the prisoner from all the others.
Yes, sir.
A remarkable feat, which you seem to have accomplished in true Sherlock Holmes fashion.
Order! Order!
Now, could you describe how you compared the prints made by the prisoner's boots with the ones you found?
Well, I put the boot by the side of the print, flat on the ground, pressed it down with both my hands, and then I eased the hand near the heel and pressed it down with the hand nearest the toe.
You put the boot by the side of the print, not in the print itself.
No, sir.
I did.
See, go on. Then I measured the print together with some more and compared them with those made by the boot. They seemed to be the same.
Seemed, Constable?
Yes, sir.
Constable, you say you measured these impressions.
Yes, sir.
With a foot rule or some such instrument?
No, sir. I had no rule with me.
Then how did you measure them?
With bits of stick, sir.
Oh, bits of stick?
Yes, sir. And a straw.
If there are any more interruptions, I shall have the court cleared. Carry on, counsel.
Uh-huh. This, a stick and a straw. I see.
And with the aid of these accurate measuring tools, you judged those prints to be identical with those made by the boot belonging to the accused.
Yes, sir. That is all. It is now 7:30. Do you have any more witnesses, Mr. Vachel?
No, Your Honor.
Then the court is adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.
You are Dr. J. H. Butter, a police surgeon.
I am.
What did you find on the prisoner's clothing taken from the vicarage?
I examined the jacket, vest, and a piece of skin cut from the horse. On the jacket, I found some reddish stains, which on being tested, proved to be mammalian blood.
That is the blood of an animal which suckles its young.
Yes, that is right.
What else did you find on the clothes?
I found 29 hairs on the jacket and 5 on the waistcoat.
Did you compare them with the hairs on a strip of skin taken from the horse?
I did.
And with what result?
I found them to be similar in color, length, and structure to those on the piece of skin.
Thank you.
Does the defense wish to cross-examine?
Yes, Your Honor. Dr. Butter, you described the stains on the clothing as being mammalian blood. How do you distinguish the two, animal blood and human blood?
Not possible to make such a distinction.
You cannot tell the difference.
No, there is no known test whereby animal's blood can be distinguished from that of a human being.
Or a human blood stain from a splash of blood from underdone meat?
No, you could not tell.
Thank you for being so clear on this point. How did you obtain the clothes and the piece of horse's hide?
They were brought to me.
By the police?
Yes.
In separate containers?
No, together in a sack.
So, the clothes and the piece of skin were bundled up together in the sack, possibly for several hours.
I believe so.
Now, Dr. Butter, I should like you to think carefully before you answer my next question. Is it not possible that the horse hairs you found on the cloak and vest came to be there through having been rubbed off from the piece of hide in the sack?
I cannot say for certain.
That was not my question. I asked you, and I repeat the question, is it not possible that the hairs came to be there in the way I described?
Yes. It is possible.
I deny that I had anything to do with the mutilation of the horse on August the 17th, nor was I connected with the outrage in any way, or with any of the other outrages.
You were offered bail. Why did you refuse?
I did not feel inclined to accept it because of the commotion which the case had aroused. This would have made it difficult for me to go backwards and forwards to business without being the object of curiosity and possibly hostility. I also felt that another outrage might be committed while I was in prison.
And you would have an alibi.
It would have been clear that I could have had nothing to do with it.
At the time of your arrest, you are reported as saying, I am not surprised at this. I have been expecting it for some time. Is that correct?
Yes, I did say that.
I suggest that these were remarks that a man might use who has something on his conscience.
No, I had no such thought.
Were these the remarks of a guilty man, as the prosecution contended? Or were they those of a man who felt he had been marked down as a victim? One question haunted George's mind.
Was there a deliberate plot to ensnare me?
It is difficult, in summing up, to overestimate the importance of detecting those guilty of these outrages which have created a reign of terror in Great Wyerley and disgraced the fair name of the county. I would add that I consider it very remarkable that no apparent motive has come out in this case other than that suggested by the Crown. Would a man go to such lengths to gain notoriety? That is a question for you, the jury, to decide. You must banish from your minds anything you might have read or heard about the case and rely entirely upon the evidence put before the court. You will now retire to consider your verdict.
The jury were out for 50 minutes.
Have you reached a verdict?
We have, Your Honor.
How do you find the prisoner? Guilty or not guilty?
Guilty. With a recommendation to mercy on account of his position.
George Adelji, you have been found guilty of a serious offense, and the court believes the verdict to be a right one. As to the recommendation for mercy on account of your position, we have on the one hand to consider this recommendation, and on the other, the disgrace which these outrages have inflicted on the county. I therefore sentence you to 7 years penal servitude.
Oh, no!
Mother, son!
Remove him from the court.
And so, George Adelji became prisoner D-462 in Lewis Jail, where he spent 6 months making feed bags for horses. Then he was transferred to Portland, and all the while the outrages against animals and the anonymous letters continued.
My name is R.D. Yelverton, formerly Chief Justice of the Bahamas. I have a petition for the Home Office. It carries the signatures of 10,000 people. They include hundreds of lawyers and barristers.
A letter from Captain Anson, Chief Constable of Staffordshire, to R.D. Yelverton.
It is right to tell you that you will find it a simple waste of time to attempt to prove that George Adelji could not, owing to his position and alleged good character, have been guilty of writing offensive and abominable letters. His father is as well aware as I am of his proclivities in the direction of anonymous writing, and several other people have personal knowledge on the same subject.
Could you please give me the names of these several other people?
There was no reply. George's name was struck from the roll of practicing solicitors. Then, on October the 16th, 1906, with 4 years of his sentence still to run, events took a new and mysterious turn.
D-462.
I have a name, Mr. Elliot.
Now, listen your lips. Come on, lad, up. The governor wants to see you.
See me? Why?
Probably wants to ask you if you need an extra pillow. Now, go on. Don't keep him waiting.
Oh, very well.
D-462,
sir. Adelji. Right. Bring him in, Mr. Marriott.
Yes, sir.
Inside. Adelji, I have some news for you. I am to tell you that you are shortly to leave Portland. You will be transferred to Pentonville Prison in London, from where you will be released.
Released?
Yes. Within a week, you will be a free man.
Free? I'll tell you that.
Would you like a chair, Adelji?
No. Thank you, sir. I'm all right. It's just a shock.
I understand. It is unexpected. There's something else I have to tell you. On the day of your discharge from Pentonville, you will have to report to Scotland Yard. They will want to know where you're staying in London. You will have to report to them every month and let them know at once if you change your address.
Why do I have to report, sir, if I've been pardoned?
No, Adelji, you have not been pardoned. You are to remain under police supervision.
But why? Am I innocent or guilty?
You will be a discharged convict. More than that, I cannot tell you.
I don't understand.
That is all, Adelji. You may return to your cell. Mr. Marriott?
Sir?
Go on. Thank you, sir.
After his release, George remained in London. Unable to practice as a solicitor, he picked up his pen and began a series of articles on his case for the Umpire, a weekly paper.
Released on a 4 year ticket of leave on the 19th of last month, after serving 3 full years out of the 7 to which I was so unjustly sentenced.
These were the articles which Sir Arthur Conan Doyle received from George Adelji towards the end of 1906. From then until well into the new year, Sir Arthur devoted all his time to studying the case.
You know, Alfred, when I received the knighthood, I did so believing that nothing should ever be allowed to disturb the established order of things. But I'm afraid that belief no longer stands on firm ground.
Because of this case, sir?
Yes. There are times when justice demands that we raise our voices against authority, whatever the cost may be, whatever the pain of shattered illusion.
But supposing Adelji is innocent, sir, how could there have been such a terrible mistake?
Mistake? It might be something worse. And judicial crimes are not done with impunity, even to the most humble. Somehow, somewhere, There comes a national punishment in return. Well, I'm familiar with the published facts of the case. Now we must meet the young man himself.
Yes, sir. Where should we fix the rendezvous?
I think the Grand Hotel Charing Cross. Book us some rooms and arrange for George Adelji to meet us there.
Excuse me, sir. Could I help you?
Yes, we're meeting someone here in the foyer. Mr. Adelji.
Oh, yes, sir. I think you'll find him over there,
where?
Sitting by the window.
Oh, yes. Yes, I see him. Thank you. Good heavens.
What is it, sir?
Do you notice the way he's reading that newspaper?
Yes, sir. Very odd. He's holding it close to his eyes. His head is sort of twisted on one side.
Yes. Most significant.
Here they are.
Well, let's go over and introduce ourselves.
Yes? Sir Arthur Conan Doyle?
Yes. And this is my secretary, Mr. Alfred Wood.
How do you do?
Very pleased to meet you, sir.
Sir Arthur, I can't tell you how grateful
I
am.
I'm only too glad to help you in any way I can. And I'm honored that you should ask me.
I turn to you because I know you have helped other people. I don't know anyone in London.
And London is a terrible city to be friendless in. Well, you're not without friends now.
I know, Sir Arthur. If you hadn't responded...
Oh, we won't talk of that. I'm here now. Let's go to my room. There are many questions to be answered. Alfred.
Sir?
Please make a note. I want you to purchase a 6-inch ordnance survey map of the Great Wiley District.
6-inch ordnance survey. Right, sir. I've got that.
And get on to Mr. Kenneth Scott of Manchester Square. He's an eye specialist. Ask him whether he'd be kind enough to make an evening appointment for Mr. Adelji as soon as possible. This report from Mr. Scott confirms my own diagnosis, Alfred. Here we are. Right eye minus 8.75 diopter, minus 1.75 diopter, cylinder axis 90 degrees. Left eye minus 8.25 diopter.
I'm afraid all that's a bit beyond me, sir.
Well, in plain language, it means that George is terribly short-sighted. In fact, I don't recall a case of myopia as severe as this when I was in practice as an oculist.
But if his eyes are that bad, sir, how could he have possibly done those crimes?
How indeed. Alfred, will you please look up a good train to Great Wiley this afternoon?
Are you going there, sir?
Yes. I want to meet the family. And there are a number of inquiries I have to make.
Very good, sir. I'll see you to the ticket.
Not ticket, Alfred. Ticket. I'll need you with me.
Yes, sir.
But if they still think George is guilty, why did they let him out of prison?
If we knew that, Reverend, we would understand many other things. One can only surmise. But I'm of the opinion that the authorities have compromised with their consciences. I believe they were shaken by all the agitation, especially by such journals as Truth.
I'm afraid there has been very little of that in the case against my son, Sir Arthur.
How was George looking when you saw him?
Not too badly, Mrs. Adelji, considering his ordeal. He's been under a great strain. But then you all have.
Yes, indeed.
It must have been a difficult time for you.
It's been a nightmare. What made them pick on George? He could never have done those horrible crimes. When I sat in court and heard them accusing him, I felt I was going mad. We've never harmed anyone. Why did they say those terrible things? Why?
I think I can tell you in a word. Prejudice. Racial prejudice of the most vicious kind. You and your family are the victims of a malignant disease,
and it is not yet over.
You mean the attitude of the villagers?
Yes, Mr. Wood. Oh, most of them have been very kind. But there are always those who will pass by on the other side.
Yes, that's the nature of the world, I'm afraid. Your position here as vicar can't have been easy.
Perhaps we are being tested in some way. It has been a heavy cross.
And one that you've borne with honor. I was convinced of your son's innocence before I came here. But now, having met you all, I'm doubly certain that a great wrong has been done, and I shall do all I can to get those in authority to admit it.
May God guide you.
Sir Arthur, do you think we shall ever know who did those horrible things?
Perhaps we shall, Miss Adelji. We must pursue the trail and see where it leads us. But now, we must go.
Yes, we must.
But won't you and Mr. Wood stay for supper?
No, thank you. You're most kind, but we have work to do. Could you please tell us how to get to Bridgetown?
I will show you the way.
Well, good night to you all.
Sir Arthur?
Hmm?
Thank you.
Courage, Mrs. Adelji. Come, Alfred.
Evening, gentlemen.
Good evening. Mr. Hand?
That's right, sir.
Mr. John Hand?
That's right. What can I do for you?
Oh, it's a matter of some importance. This is Mr. Wood.
How do you do?
sir.
And my name is Arthur Conan Doyle.
Conan Doyle? Not the Sir Arthur. Here, wait a bit. Let me find you someone to see.
Oh, no, please don't trouble yourself, Mr. Hand. We're here because we think you can help us with some inquiries we're making. On behalf of Mr. George Adelji.
Oh, yes?
I believe you were a witness at the trial.
I was, sir. But they tell me he's out now.
Yes, he is. But in very strange circumstances. His present position is far from satisfactory. Now, I'd like you to take your mind back 3 years and more.
Yes, sir.
You testified that Mr. Adelji brought some boots to you for repair on the evening of August the 17th, 1903, the night of the crime.
That's right, sir. About 8:30 it was.
You have a good memory, Mr. Hand.
Oh, I could never forget that, sir.
He left the vicarage at about 8, so it took him half an hour, which is approximately the same time it's taken us. How long was he here for, do you remember?
Oh, 5 or 10 minutes. We chatted for a while, then he left. Said he was expected back for supper.
It's probably asking too much, but do you happen to recall what kind of coat he was wearing?
Yes, I can tell you that too, sir. It was dark blue serge.
Can't be remembering a detail like that.
Oh, not at all, sir. It was the outdoor coat he always wore.
Oh, then Mr. Adelji was a regular customer of yours.
Oh, yes, sir. He'd been coming here for years.
What sort of man would you say he was?
Well, a very pleasant gentleman, sir. A bit shy, but very friendly. Oh, and very civil. Always called me Mr. And. Well, you know what I mean.
I do indeed.
A likeness costs nothing.
Yeah.
Anybody hereabouts wanted any help with legal matters? Well, he'd always give it.
And what did you think of the verdict at the trial?
Well, if you want my opinion, sir, it was all wrong. He wasn't guilty, not Mr. Adelji.
Why do you say that?
Well, I knew him. I remember one day he came in when I cut my hand. Funny how these small things stick in your mind. Well, I had a bandage on and the blood was showing through. Oh, he seemed terribly upset. No, he could never have done the things they say he did. He couldn't hurt anybody.
Thank you, Mr. Hand. You're a good judge of character, as well as an excellent craftsman, judging from these boots here.
Thank you, sir. Very kind of you to say so.
You've been most helpful. Good night, you.
Good night, Mr. Hand.
Oh, and to you too, gentlemen.
Fault of the earth, sir.
Yes, that was the whole problem.
Problem, sir? I don't understand. For whom?
For the police, my dear Wood. Can't you picture him giving evidence in court as strong and reliable as the materials of his trade? If he said 8:30, 8:30 it was. If he said George was wearing a blue serge coat, it couldn't possibly have been his grey house jacket. No jury on earth could have failed to believe him. Is it any wonder that the police had to fall back on the even more ridiculous proposition that George crept unnoticed from a locked bedroom and committed the crime at 2:00 in the morning?
Remarkable.
Self-evident, my dear Alfred. All that remains now is to demolish their theory by practical experiment. Are you feeling energetic?
Oh, I'm game for anything, sir. What do you have in mind?
A walk. Over there, about 3/4 of a mile away, judging from our map reading, is the field where that poor beast was mutilated. What we shall do is to follow the route George is supposed to have taken that night.
Oh, very well, sir.
Right. Off we go.
This bank's a bit steep.
You need a hand up, Alfred?
No, thank you, sir.
Oh, careful now. There's a ditch here. Oh, and another fence right here. Mind the barbed wire. All right?
Yes, fine, sir. Oh, quite an obstacle, of course.
Ah, I think we're approaching the field now.
Hmm? Oh, yes, there's the colliery.
Now, somewhere here must be the spot where the pony was done to death.
I'm quite puffed.
And we're both active men, Alfred. Imagine this course being run at night by someone who's nearly blind and with a score of police scouring the neighborhood.
Pretty far-fetched notion, isn't it?
It's grotesque. And to think this all-important point was not even raised at the trial.
Do you know what this reminds me of, sir?
Huh?
Who would associate crime with these quiet fields?
Ah, yes. It is my belief, Watson, founded upon my experience, that the lowest and vilest alleys in London do not present a more dreadful record of sin than does the smiling and beautiful countryside.
Oh, you horrify me, Holmes.
But the reason is very obvious. The pressure of public opinion can do in the town what the law cannot accomplish. And there is a step between the crime and the dock. But look at these lonely houses, each in its own field. and think of the deeds of hellish cruelty, the hidden wickedness, which may go on year in, year out in such places, and none the wiser.
Hmm. Now, what was the name of that story?
I'll give you a clue. Fagus Silvatica Cuprea.
Fagus Silvatica? Oh, of course, the copper beeches.
Right. But that was fiction, Elvis. The case of the Indian solicitor is fact. But now we must get back to the Star Inn. I have a night's work ahead of me. Come in.
Sorry to disturb you, sir. But it's gone 2 o'clock. You really ought to get some sleep.
No time for that. The Daily Telegraph want these articles by Thursday morning. Incidentally, they're going to be non-copyright. I insisted on that.
I see your point, sir.
The whole country is going to know the truth. Bigotry. That's what we're up against. And the chief constable, I regret to say, is the chief offender.
Why do you think Captain Anson has this hostility against George?
Because of his color, my dear Ward. Because of his color. For no other reason. And it goes back 15 years. Anson has infected the whole of his police force with his ideas.
Shocking business.
Yes, and I've said as much in this article. Now then. In all details, this seems to me to form a kind of squalid Dreyfus case. The parallel is extraordinarily close. You have a Parsee instead of a Jew with a young and promising career blighted. In each case, the degradation from a profession and the campaign for redress and restoration. In each case, questions of forgery and handwriting arise, with Esther Harvey in the one and the anonymous writer in the other. Finally, I regret to say that in the one case you have a clique of French officials going from excess to excess in order to cover an initial mistake, and that in the other, you have the Staffordshire police acting in the way I have described.
You know, you've had your nose in that telegraph since lunch. What are you reading?
A damned interesting article.
May I?
Do.
Thank you. The case of Mr. George Dalry, special investigation by Sir A. Conan Doyle. Heavens, there must be all of 10,000 words there.
And the same yesterday.
Good, is it?
Fellow Ward knew his case well, I'll say that. Would have made a good lawyer.
Or an MP?
No, that I doubt. Too passionate by half.
All heart and no head, eh?
No, he has both. An unpopular combination in the House.
There goes
Vision
Bell.
I've
come to report, Sergeant.
Ah, yes. Name of Vidalgi?
That's right.
Still at the same address?
Yes. 2 Mecklenburg Street.
All right. Sign here.
Thank you.
Yes, sir, you're famous.
Oh, yes, the Telegraph articles.
Got old Sherlock Holmes on the scent, eh?
Sir Arthur Conan Doyle has been very helpful.
Ah, he's wasting his time.
He believes I'm innocent.
Oh, does he now?
And I am.
All right, all right. See you next month.
Listen! Listen to this! Listen! Now we turn to the last tribunal of all. A tribunal which never airs when the facts are fairly laid before them. And we are the public of Great Britain. When are the things to go on? That's what Conan Doyle asked in his paper. And we, the Society for Law and Order, ask whether all this agitation against the authority is to go on. The writing is on the wall, plain for all to see. Is it rude? Oh, you can laugh, sir. You can laugh. But you won't be laughing when the fabric of our society is torn asunder. Beware. Beware those who would undermine the forces of law and order for their own ends. The creation of anarchy.
Rubbish!
It is far from rubbish. I tell you, Conan Doyle is playing a dangerous game. Defending a convicted criminal. Oh, George Adelgi is no ordinary criminal, I grant you. He's a very clever man. He's won gold medals, and he's written a book on railway law. But, whose side is he on?
Liverpool!
We live in perilous times. We are surrounded by enemies who seek to destroy us. And what better way than by spreading unrest and disaffection? We have the finest police force in the world. What right does Conan Doyle to cast a slur on their integrity?
Mind you, Wood. I deprecate a public outcry, but we have no alternative. The door has been shut in our faces, and we must force it open.
I rather think the Home Secretary has his shoulder to it on the other side, sir.
Then we shall see whose is the stronger. I fancy it'll be mine. If it were his father now, the grand old man, I'd be taking on a mountain. But Herbert Gladstone? He's a foothill.
My dear Sir Arthur.
Mr. Gladstone, I'm obliged to you, sir, for this interview.
Not at all. My pleasure. Please be seated.
I need hardly tell you that my concern over the case of Mr. George Edalji is shared by many of our fellow citizens.
Yes, I gather the correspondence columns of our newspapers are somewhat fuller than usual.
It is not merely a question of letters to the press, Mr. Secretary, sir. Expressions of disquiet have come from many distinguished quarters.
And all without cause or foundation, I assure you.
You will have difficulty in assuring me, sir. There are questions to be answered.
Then ask them, my dear fellow.
Who was responsible for deciding that Edalji should go free but remain guilty?
Ah, that is a question that I'm afraid I cannot answer.
Say, sir, why? Is it a state secret?
It is a matter of political prudence.
You outrun me, sir.
Surely not, Sir Arthur. There are always political considerations in these matters. I'm sure you understand that. You stood for Parliament twice, did you not?
Yes, and was defeated, right?
Regrettably.
Perhaps it was just as well. I could never really imagine myself a separate to a party, or as thinking that all virtues lay with one set of men.
You raise a philosophical question.
Now let me raise another, and it's a very simple one. Do you intend to re-examine the case of Mr. Edalji?
There is no simple answer to that.
Why not, sir?
There are practical difficulties. We have as yet no provision for appeals against criminal convictions, although, of course, such a reform had been under consideration since the unfortunate case of Adolf Beck.
Another innocent man who was sent to prison.
As you say.
Do you mean that Edalji's sentence must stand because there is no legal machinery for dealing with it?
As regards a retrial, yes.
It's monstrous.
It is unfortunate, but that is the law.
Then the law must be changed.
That is a matter for Parliament.
You are the Home Secretary.
And my hands are tied.
Then we shall have to untie them, sir, even if it means calling a protest meeting in Trafalgar Square.
I would never have imagined you in the role of a public agitator, Sir Arthur.
There are times, Mr. Home Secretary, when it is criminal not to agitate.
I am saddened to think that you should regard me as an enemy. I sympathize with your predicament.
Not mine. Edalji's and his family's. They are the ones who are suffering.
Your concern for them is admirable. Though I cannot share your certainty that there has been a miscarriage of justice in this case.
But you will admit, sir, that these are exceptional circumstances.
They are, I agree, not normal.
Yet you will do nothing.
No. Something can be done. I am prepared to appoint a special committee of unbiased men to examine and report on this case.
And there will be public hearings?
No useful purpose would be served by such an arrangement. The atmosphere would be too highly charged with emotion. The sessions will be held in camera. But the committee will study all relevant data, and they will be asked to make recommendations as to what course we should take.
If any.
If any.
Well, it's something. But it's not ideal.
Nothing is ideal in this world, Sir Arthur.
Then have you decided to do this in response to public pressure?
Oh, no. The government never submits to pressure of that kind.
Inform the House when we may expect to hear the names of the members comprising his special committee to inquire into the Edalji case and their terms of reference.
I am grateful for the opportunity to reply to this question, and I am pleased to tell the House that the committee referred to has now been appointed. It comprises three members, eminently qualified for this responsible and, may I say, onerous task. They are Sir Arthur Wilson, PC, Mr. John Lloyd Wharton, and Sir Robert Roper. Their brief is to examine all the evidence in the case, to apprise me of their findings, and to recommend such action as they consider necessary or desirable.
The Staffordshire Advertiser, March the 2nd, 1907. Sir Robert Roper takes the view that the inquiry should be public. The proposed committee would have no power to call witnesses or administer an oath. And he does not see his way to act as judge or jury in trying the question of the guilt or innocence of Mr. Adalji without the legal power of summoning witnesses. Sir Robert adds that his colleagues entirely concur with his views. The Home Office announces that Sir A. de Rutzen, Chief Metropolitan Magistrate, has consented to take Sir Robert's place, and the examination of the papers is now proceeding.
Alfred, where's my who's who?
Here, sir.
Thank you. Now then, who is this new member of the committee who has managed to allay the doubts raised by the outspoken Sir Robert? Here we are. De Rutzen Albert Baronet. Oh.
Something wrong, sir?
Yes, Alfred, disturbingly wrong. I fear we can no longer expect an impartial verdict from the new Gladstone Committee. The Home Secretary assured me it's composed of unbiased men.
And isn't it?
Well, I say nothing of the other two. But the new third member cannot be described as a wholly disinterested party. Do you know who Sir Albert Durrison is?
Judge, sir.
Yes, and something else besides. He happens to be a second cousin of Captain Anson, Chief Constable of the County of Staffordshire.
Good gracious, what an odd coincidence.
Coincidence, my dear Wood? And is it also coincidence that Sir Reginald Hardy, who presided over the court which sentenced George Adalji, has a wife whose maiden name was Gladstone? No, for she is a cousin of Mr. Herbert Gladstone, the Home Secretary.
Good heavens. No wonder they say blood's thicker than water.
Yes, and never more so than when it's blue. Come in.
Your letter, sir.
Oh, thank you, Alice.
And a postcard.
Arthur, look, she...
Give me a hand, Alfred. Now, let's get on to the couch.
What's wrong with her, sir?
It's some time since I was in general practice, but I say she's fainted. Pulse sluggish. Oh, would you please get myself a letter?
Yes, sir.
Now, what made her do that? She was handing me the postcard. So where is it? Ah, yes, here it is. Oh, I see.
Here we are, sir.
Thank you, Al. I'll just sprinkle a few drops on my handkerchief. Let her in here.
Where am I? What?
It's all right, Alice. Don't try to get up.
Oh. What happened?
There's nothing to be alarmed about. You fainted.
Oh.
She isn't ill, is she, sir?
I don't believe so. I'd say she was suffering from delayed shock. Am I right, Alice?
Oh, no, sir. Really, I'm not.
Are you sure?
Yes, sir. Please, sir. Can I get back to work?
In a moment. Now, why did you faint?
I don't know, sir.
I think you do.
No. Honest, sir.
I think you read this postcard before you came in, and the contents upset you.
Oh, sir.
There now. There's no need to cry. It's all over.
I don't know what you must think of me.
I think your curiosity is stronger than your constitution.
Oh, I feel so ashamed.
Then we'll say no more about it. How are you feeling now?
Oh, all right, sir. Thank you.
You think you can stand?
Yes, sir.
Now, steady.
Oh, I really am sorry, sir. Please forgive me.
I do, Alice.
I don't understand, sir. Why should a postcard make a faint?
Read it.
God, Phil.
Posted in Great Wiley, you'll notice. And if we look through these letters, I shouldn't be surprised that, as I thought, another communication from the same source and in the same hand. Let's see what it says. I know from a detective for Scotland Yard that if you write to Gladstone and say you find Adalji is guilty, after all, they'll make you a lord next year. Is it not better to be a lord than to run the risk of losing kidneys and liver? Think of all the ghoulish murders that are committed. Why then should you escape?
No.
The punctuation's atrocious. And there's more. Adalji wrote all the letters, you blind fool. Don't you know he was at school with that blasted Gregory?
That's the boy whose signature was forged on some of the letters.
Right. It goes on now. There was no education to be got at Walsall where that bloody spine Aldis was high school boss. The proof of what I tell you is in the writing he put in the papers when they loosed him out of prison
where he ought to be kept along with his dad, an all black and yellow-faced Jew.
Unspeakable. What wouldn't I give to meet him face to face?
You'll have to forego such an encounter for the time being, Wood. Oh, meanwhile, please be good enough to hand me that box, glass.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And my magnifying glass.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Here we are now. The 1903 letters bearing the forged signature of young Greatorex. It's a pity we don't have the originals, but these photographs will serve our purpose. Now, if we compare them with the missive I've just received and the postcard, I fancy we shall... Yes, my assumption was correct. There's been a clumsy attempt to disguise the handwriting, but there's no mistaking the similarity.
By heaven, sir, yes, you're right.
Yes, and there's something else that's always intrigued me, Wood. After the anonymous letters of 1892 to 95, there was silence, wasn't there, for nearly 8 years. Then they started again. And in this very first letter received in 1903, there are several lyrical references to life at sea.
Mm.
And the same allusion is made in several of the others. Well, here, for example, if they ever catch me for the murder, I think they'll not hang me, but send me to sea.
Now, start.
Now, what else do these letters tell us about our Mr. X?
He's foul-mouthed and illiterate.
Oh, that, certainly. But they also tell us, do they not, that he went to Walsall Grammar School and that he hated the headmaster. I think we may safely assume that that's who he means when he talks about the high school bus holders. And I'm equally certain that X was in some trouble at school, hence his unbridled animosity towards the head. Now we come to Greatorex, the boy who had nothing to do with the affair.
Oh, I remember, sir. He was away in the Isle of Man at the time.
Mm-hmm, he was. And he, too, was a pupil of Walsall Grammar.
I just remembered something else, sir. The key that was found on the doorstep of the vicarage.
Capital. Yes, that, too, came from the school at Walsall. You see how all our clues point in the same direction? It is there, my dear Wood, that we shall find the center of the maze. Mr. Aldis, you were formerly headmaster of Walsall Grammar School, I believe.
Yes, Sir Arthur, during the 90s.
Yes. You must have had hundreds of boys passing through your hands during that time.
Oh, many hundreds.
And no two were alike?
As you say, each one was an individual, and I remember them all.
Good. Then you won't mind my asking.
Well, like elephants, you know, we teachers.
Thick-skinned, eh?
Yes. No, not exactly.
I believe Mr. Aldis was alluding to the widely held notion that elephants have good memories.
Yes, I was.
An erroneous belief. But do you happen to recall any pupil who was particularly out of the ordinary, abnormal?
Oh, yes.
You do?
Chadwick. Remarkable boy.
Tell me about him.
He came from quite humble background. His father was a forester, but he had an astonishing intellect. Fluent Greek and Latin at 15. Went to Cambridge, gained a tripod.
No, that wasn't
do
what I...
Do you know why they call it a tripod?
Yes, because of the custom whereby a B.A. known as Mr. Tripod sat on a three-legged stool and disputed in the philosophy school of Cambridge on Ash Wednesday.
Excellent.
But I didn't mean exceptional in that way. No, I was referring to...
Athletic prowess. Oh, we had a number of outstanding boys. But chiefly I remember Dawson. He ran for Britain in the second Olympic Games in Paris in 1900.
No, Mr. Aldis, I'm afraid we're talking at cross purposes. By abnormal, I meant not conforming to accepted standards of behavior.
Oh, you mean a boy with antisocial tendencies?
Precisely.
That kind of thing was not tolerated at Walsall. At least not while I was there. Of course, standards may have slackened since.
But you must have had some pupils like that, surely.
Not that I recall.
Oh, think, man, think. Much may depend on it.
This is quite pointless, Sir Arthur.
Mr. Aldis, there's a man's whole future at stake here, and the well-being of his family. Now, I urge you to cast from your mind all considerations which you might mistakenly feel are to your discredit, and concentrate on the single question, was there such a boy as I describe?
Yeah. Let me think. Yes, I remember now. He was only there for a couple of years.
Yes?
I had to expel him because he was an incorrigible liar and innately vicious. He had a particular taste for using a knife.
Ah.
He used to rip up cushions in trains and pull out all the horsehair. He later became apprenticed to a butcher. Then he went to sea, I understand, and served for a time on a cattle boat. Oh, there was a mad streak in him. He did mad, senseless things.
What things?
Oh, forging letters.
His name, Mr. Aldis. What was his name?
I can't remember.
Oh, try.
No, it's gone. I'm sorry.
Well, it's a lot to expect.
It was 15 years ago.
You did your best. Come, Alfred.
Good day to you, sir.
Wait!
What?
Sharp. Yes, that was it. Sharp. Royden Sharp.
Why should anyone want to implicate your son, Mrs. Gretrick?
Spoiled, if you ask me. But it doesn't make any sense, whichever way you look at it. Bobby wouldn't do a thing like that, writing those horrible letters. Besides, he wasn't ever here at the time.
No, we know.
Proper mystery it is.
Yes, indeed. Your son was at school in Walsall with George Adalgie, I believe.
Yes, he was.
Do you think Adalgie was behind it all?
Well, I know they said he was. And they sent him to prison for it, but I don't know. It never seemed right to me. George Adalgie and my Bobby were chums. Bobby often brought him home for tea. Very polite lad he was. Oh, it's a real old jigsaw puzzle, the old thing. I've never been able to work it out.
Nor can we hope to until we have all the pieces. Tell me, do you happen to remember a young man by the name of Royden Sharp?
Remember Royden Sharp? I'm not likely to forget him, especially at that time when all the cattle maiming was going on.
What happened then, Mrs. Petrick?
Summer it was. I'd known the Sharps for years, and I'd gone round to their house, you know, for a chat. We were talking about the poor animals, and Royden was there. Well, he'd been away at sea for 7 or 8 years, and come home 6 months previous. He seemed to get very excited when the animals were mentioned. Kept saying George Adalgie had done it. In fact, he added in for the old family. Don't ask me why. Anyway, he got up all of a sudden. He went to a cupboard and got out a funny kind of knife. Big thing it was. Never seen anything like it.
Could you describe it?
Well, it didn't come to a point. More rounded it was, with a sort of bump at the end of the blade.
Ah, go on.
And then he said, look at this. That's what they kill the cattle with. Oh, I felt quite ill. And the look on his face. Oh, I couldn't describe it.
As though he enjoyed telling you about it.
That's right, sir. That's it exactly.
How did you know that?
It was obvious, Wood. We're dealing with a man of sadistic propensity.
The knife was a horse lancet. Conan Doyle managed to get possession of it. How, we need not inquire. He had his methods. He made a sketch of it and included it with a report he sent to the Home Secretary.
The case against Royden Sharp. The wounds in all the outrages up to August the 18th were of a very peculiar character. In every case, there was a shallow incision. It had cut through skin and muscles, but had not penetrated the gut. Had an ordinary cutting weapon been used, it must certainly, in some instance, have penetrated far enough to pierce the gut with its point or edge. Note that the blade of the horse lancet is very sharp, yet it could never penetrate more than superficially. I submit this very large horse lancet, obtained by Royden Sharp from the cattle ship, as being the only kind of instrument which could have committed all the crimes. This seems to me in itself a complete case, and if I, a stranger in the district, have been able to collect it, I cannot doubt that fresh evidence would come out after his arrest. He appears to have taken very little pains to hide his proceedings, and how there could at any time have been any difficulty in pointing him out as the criminal is to me an extraordinary thing.
Conan Doyle submitted his detailed and carefully reasoned report to the Home Office and awaited their reply. In May 1907, the findings and recommendations of the Gladstone Committee were made public. Mr. Ernley Blackwell of the Home Office.
The committee reports, in our opinion, the conviction was unsatisfactory, and we cannot agree with the verdict of the jury. On the other hand, we agree that Adalgie was the writer of the letters of 1903, and that he has therefore, to some extent, brought his troubles upon himself.
I demand to see the Home Secretary.
The Home Secretary is not available, Sir Arthur. I am acting for him.
And who might you be, sir?
My name is Ernley Blackwell. I take it you've come about Adalgie.
I've come to protest about this outrageous verdict. I say to you, sir, and I say to Mr. Gladstone, that these miserable findings are an affront to the civilized conscience. Adalgie has therefore, to some extent, brought his troubles upon himself. What meaningless rubbish is this?
I must ask
And why has the Home Secretary decided that no compensation can be granted? It's intolerable, and I'm not alone in thinking so. Countless members of Parliament have shown their concern by their questions in the House. One pressed the Home Secretary to confirm that Adalgie was innocent. And the answer? It is a matter of opinion. It was not a matter of opinion when the Gladstone Committee declared Adalgie guilty of writing the anonymous letters. And on what evidence? on that of a single so-called expert.
Really, sir?
Why has no action been taken against Royden Sharp? Why has nothing been done about my report? If you've taken the trouble to read it.
I have.
Then you'll know there's a prima facie case.
I know nothing of the kind. Our law officers advise us that there is no case against Sharp. You have maligned an innocent man.
Innocent?
Royden Sharp is no more guilty than I am.
You are guilty, sir, of willful blindness. Sharp wrote the letters and Sharp did the killings. No other verdict is possible.
I would advise you, Sir Arthur, not to persist in these allegations.
Mr. Blackwell, do you maintain that Georgie Dalby is raving mad?
There is no indication to that effect.
Has there ever been any suggestion that he's mad?
Not to my knowledge.
Then do you seriously suggest that he sent me 7 violent letters threatening my life?
I can do no more than refer you to the Gladstone Committee's report. Here we are, page 6. These letters can have only a very remote bearing on whether Adalgie was rightly convicted in 1903.
Mr. Blackwell, it was always apparent to me that the criminal in this case was insane. I am now beginning to wonder whether insanity has spread to the Home Office.
You have heard my final words, Sir Arthur. The case of George Adalgie is closed.
It is not closed. I will not leave the job half finished.
Once more, Conan Doyle charged into battle. During June to August, he wrote further articles in the Daily Telegraph, asking...
Who wrote the letters? I have just received a most careful and weighty report upon the Adalgie documents from Dr. Lindsay Johnson, the well-known expert who assisted Metz Labori to unravel the mysteries of the Dreyfus Bordereau. Could the forged Greatorex letters of 1903 have possibly been written by Mr. George Adalgie?
The letters signed Adalgie and Greatorex have nothing in common. The former are those of an educated man. They exhibit no errors in spelling or style. The handwriting is that of a man who has written precisely in the same way, which shows a writer of regular and orderly habits, and every full stop is inserted. The forged Greatorex letter is in a cramped and apparently disguised hand. It is unquestionably the style of an uneducated man, irregular in his habits. It is practically unpunctuated throughout.
Dr. Lindsay Johnson also had specimens of Royden Sharp's handwriting obtained by Conan Doyle. Everything pointed to Sharp as the author of the anonymous letters, and it was an independent verdict.
I have purposely avoided reading your articles in the paper, lest they should bias my mind.
The conclusions to which you have come are exactly the same as my own, though founded upon a far closer scrutiny and upon more elaborate methods.
The case of George Adalgie is closed.
George paid a final visit to Scotland Yard.
Why, Mr. Adalgie. Nice of you to drop in.
I've come to say goodbye.
What?
I've been pardoned, Sergeant, didn't you know?
Me? How can I be expected to know anything? So I won't be seeing you again.
Not unless you need legal advice.
Oh, going back to that, are you? Thought you'd been struck off.
The Law Society have readmitted me.
Well, I'm blowed. I suppose I will be hearing about this officially.
Yes, I'm expecting a letter of pardon from the Home Secretary.
Look, tell me something. What made him change his mind?
The truth. And someone to fight for it.
George Adalgie remained in London, gaining his livelihood from a humble legal practice in the Borough High Street, Lambeth. But he was never cleared of the charge of writing anonymous letters. He never received a penny damages, nor to this day has the Home Office acknowledged that there was a miscarriage of justice. No one could give George back the 3 years he had spent in prison, or take away the anguish of his persecuted family. But George's sufferings, brought home to the country at large through the efforts of Conan Doyle, were not wholly in vain. They led directly to the creation in 1907 of the Court of Criminal Appeal, after 32 previous attempts to set up such a court had failed. On November 2nd, 1911, Sir Arthur wrote to his mother, "I have written to the new Home Secretary about Adalgie. I'll win that fight yet."
I was wrong. I had underestimated the strength of the enemy. The sad fact is that officialdom in England stands solid together, and that when you are forced to attack it, you need not expect justice, but rather that you're up against an unavowed trade union,
the members of which are not going to act the blackleg to each other, and which subordinates the public interest to a false idea of loyalty. What confronts you is a determination to admit nothing which inculpates another official, and as to the idea of punishing another official for offenses which have caused misery to helpless victims, it never comes within their horizon.
Oh, Alfred, sir? Could you get me a list of all the chemists in the Great Wiley area? I shall need to write to them.
Very good, sir.
The fight goes on.
Indeed, sir.
And go on, it did. Proof of this can be found in a letter written to a chemist in Cannock and presented by his son-in-law in 1971 to the Victoria Theatre, Stoke-on-Trent, where this play was being staged.
Undershaw, Hindhead, Hazelmere, August the 31st, 1907. Dear sir, could you tell me if anyone has purchased aniseed, either as balsam or in any other form of late? It is, as you know, used to attract horses, and may have been so in this case. Of course, such a purchase may have been quite innocent, but I should be obliged if in this crisis you would submit to me for my own information the name of any male customer who has recently bought such preparations. The public good must be my excuse for troubling you. I am, dear sir, yours truly, Arthur Conan Doyle.
In Conan Doyle Investigates by Roger Waddiff, Carlton Hobbs played Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, with Graham Armitage as Alfred Wood, Brian Hewlett as George Edalji, Edward Kelsey as the Reverend Chapoji Edalji, Penelope Shaw as Charlotte, and Susan Tracy as Maud. Captain the Honourable George Anson, Sir Reginald Harvey, and others were played by Paul Chapman, Inspector Campbell by John Malcolm, Thomas Gurin, Mr. Aldis, and others by George Woolley, and Sergeant Upton by Ralph Lawton. Dr. Butter and others by Arthur Pentelow, Mr. Disternal and Mr. Herbert Gladstone by Peter Yap, and Mr. Vachel, Dr. Lindsay Johnson and others by Basil Jones. Also taking part were Gerald Turner, Daniel Bryan, and James Duckett. Production in Birmingham by Anthony Cornish.